It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, an unassuming windowless building on the UW-Madison campus can simulate almost any climate on Earth. It's called Biotron, and we'll talk to the director.
First, a Democratic state senator is introducing a handful of bills this week aimed at addressing staffing shortages and other problems at Wisconsin correctional facilities. The bills come after news of a State Department of Justice raid on a juvenile corrections facility and concerns over working conditions at those facilities around the state.
The legislation would pave the way for things like increased on-the-job training, a limit on forced overtime, and would give Department of Corrections employees the power to collectively bargain over workplace safety.
Here with us now to take a closer look at these bills is Patrick Marley, who covers state politics and state government from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
So why are we seeing this passel of legislation now from a Democratic minority state senator?
So Senator Erpenbach he's got a couple prisons in his district. He had heard about some concerns there. He held sort of a public forum this summer or fall where he heard from folks who work at Columbia Correctional Institution in Portage and other nearby institutions. They raised a lot of concerns about the significant staffing shortages that they have there. And he then later met with the Corrections Secretary Ed Wall, and this is his proposed fix to a number of these issues.
So in addition to those kind of ongoing concerns about staffing, there's been this big, high-profile scandal at a youth correctional facility up in northern Wisconsin. Is that part of the impetus, do you think, behind this legislation?
He says no. So this, what we've been writing about recently with Lincoln Hill School up a little bit north of Wausau, really came out in December. We found out about this year-long investigation that is still ongoing, very significant crimes that are, they're concerned may have been committed regarding neglect of prisoners, sexual abuse, physical abuse of prisoners. These are children. That all developed after Erpenbach had been hearing from people about these staffing shortages, which are a problem at all the institutions statewide. And so he says that the Lincoln Hill situation is not what's prompting his particular legislation.
Well, let's dig into some of the specific proposals here. One, and this seems like it would be a tough sell to Republicans, restoring some collective bargaining rights to prison workers, correctional workers, to bargain over workplace safety in particular. What has Erpenbach said to make the case for that one?
Well, he says that workplace safety is something that was lost under Act 10, something you could negotiate over, and that it's a very important factor for the job for people in corrections in particular, saying that the frontline staff are the ones who understand the security best because they live it every day. They have contact with inmates. They may know about problems that are emerging that management doesn't see as quickly. So he believes they should be able to negotiate over that portion of their working conditions. That's going to be a no-go with Republicans controlling the legislature. There's only a couple of months left in the legislative session. So I think of his proposals, all of which will have a tough road, him being a Democrat in a Republican-controlled legislature, that is the one that's got the highest obstacle.
When it comes to issues of staffing and training, what kind of things are included in these pieces of legislation?
Well, right now, if you get a job at the Department of Corrections, before you start, you spend 7 weeks at an academy, you get trained on what to do, and then you get taken to the institution. He's concerned that there's not enough additional training once you get there because of these staffing shortages. He's saying that they have to put people on the job right away, and he believes that that's contributing to people quitting soon after they start the job because he doesn't think that they have enough training. So his legislation would require that after the 7 weeks of initial training you get, once you arrive at the institution, you have an additional 4 weeks of training, that you'd be there on the scene and get better acclimated to the institution before you were working on your own, so to speak.
So more training and one goal to prevent turnover as well, it sounds like.
Yes, because he believes that that's part of the problem with staffing shortages is not just that they can't hire enough people, but they cannot retain the people that they do hire, or they can't retain enough of them.
Is there anything in the legislation calling for funding for more staff at prisons around the state?
A little bit. One thing that the legislature did this summer was they eliminated some positions for the people who work in the towers at state institutions. He would restore that. He would also create a couple of positions, I think about 5 per institution, requiring that you would have a first responder so that when an assault happens or another incident happens, that you have designated people there in addition to your regular staff who would respond to those situations. So it would increase marginally the total staffing, number of positions available. But, you know, we've got thousands of officers statewide, so it's really not that big of an increase. His main focus is on trying to fill the existing positions or there, you know, making changes that he says will make it easier to hire people and keep them on the job.
Talking to Patrick Marley from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about some proposed legislation changing some of the way things would work at Department of Corrections facilities, prisons, juvenile facilities around the state. Now, there have been these rumblings over staffing shortages, maybe unsafe conditions for a while now. Have we heard anything from the Department of Corrections on how they're trying to deal with these issues?
Well, the Department of Corrections has been doing a number of things to try to address this problem. They say that they are trying to up their recruiting efforts. They've also, some institutions have had such shortages, well, at least one, Columbia, where they've been sending in officers from other institutions, paying them mileage, paying them for hotels so they can work additional shifts here. There's been discussion of making people work 12-hour shifts instead of 8-hour shifts at various institutions. That idea seems to have been shelved. And perhaps the most significant thing is Ed Wall, the corrections secretary, has said that he's going to raise pay for correctional officers, but he has not given us any details as to when that would be implemented, how much of a raise there would be, and what the cost to taxpayers would be.
And the overtime issue, I know, has been a big one, both in terms of costs and maybe possible risks of having the same correctional officer working, you know, 16-hour shifts, 12-hour shifts back, you know, day after day after day. Has that been addressed by the Department of Corrections or in this legislation from Senator Erpenbach?
Well, it's, if you talk to frontline correctional officers, they say it's a concern that they're getting forced to work so much that they're, you know, they're concerned about their lives outside, you know, the impact it has on their personal lives. But also, I think some have a concern that there's going to be a level of fatigue, that you're going to have officers who work so much that they're not as alert as they need to be if incidents arise, and incidents do arise in institutions. Erpenbach, one thing that he has in his legislation is that officers would not be allowed to work more than 2 16-hour shifts in a day. So if you're forced to work overtime 2 days in a row, the next day the most you could work would be 8 hours, and that is aimed at giving people some relief so that they are fresh enough to do that job that can be dangerous.
Is there any thought that any of this proposed legislation from, again, a senator in the minority party has much of a chance, or is this mainly just symbolic, trying to raise attention to these issues?
He says it's not symbolic, but it is. It not only is the challenge for him that he's in the party that doesn't control things, it's that it's introduced in January of a year when the legislature is likely to only go until, say, March, and then they'll be off for the year to campaign. So the legislative session is very short. It's very late to introduce legislation that has a chance of getting passed.
As you talk to people in the legislature, is there a worry that maybe this Lincoln Hills story might be related to these staffing problems? We're going to see more scandals, more investigations in other facilities if something isn't done?
Well, I think that Lincoln Hills is definitely not immune to the staffing problems that we've seen elsewhere. You know, the concerns about staffing there are very real, and they're similar to other institutions. And you have it perhaps even more aggravated there in that a dozen or so people have been put on administrative leave, paid leave while they're being investigated, and so that makes you have an even bigger staffing shortage. You know, there's no indications at this point that the kind of alleged abuse that occurred at Lincoln Hills has occurred at other institutions, so I think for now we need to really keep these things as two separate issues that need to be looked at, sort of the staffing problem institution-wide, and then the particular incidents at Lincoln Hills that are being investigated.
Patrick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
That's Patrick Marley, state government reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us to talk about new legislation aimed at addressing staffing shortages and other problems at Wisconsin prisons. Now we visit a research facility on the UW-Madison campus that's open for researchers in the public and private realms. It's called Biotron and can recreate any kind of climate on Earth except apparently Antarctica.
Hannah Carey joins us now from the Netherlands to tell us more about it. She's the director of Biotron and a professor of comparative biosciences at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Hannah, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be with you.
Well, so start us out by answering the question, what is Biotron? How do you describe it?
The Biotron is a research facility on the UW-Madison campus that provides very unique environments for researchers at UW-Madison, others at the UW, within the UW system, and even for commercial clients in the area that want to take advantage of environments that they may not be able to get anywhere else.
So talk about the environments that you can create in Biotron. What's the variety of things that someone might see if they went from project to project there?
Well, someone who takes a walk through the Biotron, as our staff do on a daily basis when they're monitoring the rooms, are moving from of an environment like the Arctic, where hibernating ground squirrels are sleeping away in little caged burrows, to the tropics, where it's moist, high humidity, and very, very warm, to rooms where the light is changing in intensity and products, plants can be tested at a range of light intensities that will affect their growth or their shelf life, and even into the freeze-thaw cycles that we often notice on our roads when concrete is buckling and changing when we go through our temperature extremes. We have researchers in the College of Engineering who are studying concrete, and they use our room to simulate wide ranges of temperature.
Are there other facilities out there like Biotron, or is it one of its kind?
This is really a unique facility. There's maybe, even worldwide, there's maybe only about five at the most that can do the range that we do. That is, provide these controlled environments for not only plants, animals of many types, various materials for research and testing, and also, as I say, commercial clients who want to make sure their customers have a reliable product and that holds up well under different environmental capabilities. So we are very unique with the breadth that we can offer.
It's got to free up researchers, because if you're, you know, that engineer studying freeze-thaw and you're hoping to do that in Wisconsin in December, you would have been out of luck because there wasn't a lot of freezing going on. If you're trying to study, as you said, maybe potatoes or something like that, how is this product going to work on a potato in Wisconsin versus the deep south or something like that? When you get researchers who first check this thing out, do they weep tears of joy that they have this opportunity?
Do. In fact, sometimes we have people come through that had no idea a facility like this was available. They've heard about it through the grapevine, or we're starting to present at various trade and research conferences, and people come up and say, wow, this is just what I've been looking for. And you're right, we have a study going right now in terms of potatoes that Dr. Betsky's group in the Department of Horticulture on campus is simulating summer, hot summer weather for potatoes right now to see how heat stress affects potato growth. So it doesn't really matter what season for certain projects that you're in the calendar year, you can simulate it in the Biotron.
Can you tell us a little bit about how it works, how you get these precisely controlled microclimates within a single building? I'm sure the answer could take a day, but give us the outline.
Yeah, well, you know, we're lucky in that the building was built, it was really built in the late 60s, and it was designed in a way where rooms are isolated, and some of them are even noise and vibration isolated as well. But this allows multiple air handling units to be matched with individual rooms and provide very precise control over temperatures from -5 Fahrenheit up to 110. We can go with some of these rooms. Humidity also at a huge range. And as I said, lighting, et cetera. But a critical part of this, of course, is monitoring. You really need to know and be able to see what's happening in each room. And for this, we're very fortunate that, a local Wisconsin company right from our state, Johnson Controls, is responsible for the sensors and the computer control systems that automate these rooms and allow us to provide the best assurance for the researchers and the commercial clients that we're on top of any slight deviation in the pattern that they request.
And as I understand it, it's really important that researchers can isolate parts of their project from each other so that, I don't know, the potatoes in room A don't contaminate the ones in B, or I think the snails were an issue, that snails don't accidentally breed with the wrong kind of snail in the next room over. So these are really, really isolated from one another, too.
Yes, that's right. I study hibernating ground squirrels, and my squirrels are very happy doing their hibernation thing in a cold, dark room, isolated in the room, yet right next door to them is cheese being studied for temperature variations and light intensity. And in another room could be a certain plant being examined. So you would normally not be able to mix these kinds of research projects in such a closed space, but because of the very, very controlled and beautifully isolated nature of the rooms and the way this building was built, we're able to do this very efficiently, actually.
Well, Hannah, it sounds fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
That was Hannah Carey, director of Biotron and a professor of comparative biosciences in the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. She joined us there to talk about Biotron, a research facility at UW-Madison that can recreate almost any climate on Earth except for Antarctica.
I want to get the Biotron designers in here to Vilas Hall, where we basically have the opposite. We have no control of it. It's either we have two settings, too cold
blistering
or too hot
or
here in our studio. Yeah,
cold.
So we could each have our own microclimate, Veronica.
Oh, we could be an individual
at long
pass.
Last. A new project out of central Wisconsin looks to capture the voices of a group of people that we don't always hear from, our state's rural residents.
Through a series of oral interviews, the People of Rural Wisconsin Project looks to share the stories of rural residents throughout the state. It also hopes to answer some pretty big questions about the relationship between place and identity and why that matters in today's globalized world.
Joining us now is Matt Groshek. He's senior lecturer of graphic design at UW-Stevens Point, a faculty fellow at the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service, and he's the project director for People of Rural Wisconsin. He joins us now from our studio in Wausau. Matt, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Veronica and Rob. Thank you for having me.
So we mentioned it a bit there in the intro, but in your words, what is the People of Rural Wisconsin project all about?
Right now and in the past, recent past, it's been about collecting oral histories from people that have lived in rural places or live in rural places currently in Wisconsin. That's the short version. I think it's also looking to really listen to people's stories and histories so we can understand better what's going on in those places.
Let's elaborate a little bit more on that. Why do you think it's so important that these stories get told, get shared?
I think that in our culture in particular in other places, we sort of discount rural. It's often defined as what isn't urban. And really, Wisconsin, a large part of it is a rural place. I think that we need to pay attention again to the continuum between what's rural and urban as a way to understand all those places. And those stories help us shape an understanding of that.
Now, as you're talking to people and collecting these interviews, what kind of questions are you asking?
Questions really range from, you know, what they think rural is, how they came to live in a place, what their work is in those places, what they believe their life values are in those places. Their relationships with the land, I think, enter into this. In the end, a lot of questions have to do with identity and place. I mean, something that you've already identified.
Can you give us a sense of the scope of different people that you've talked to so far, the age range and, you know, the different professions? Who are they?
I mean, that's been pretty broad in some ways. It's across the state geographically. When the project began, Ed Janis, who was a public historian, initiated this project. He was very much interested in people who had been in farming, dairy farmers, and especially an aging population. So a lot of the stories come from people that are older, that live in rural places or have lived there. And some of them are farming. Some of those people are working in small towns in different sorts of jobs. It really depends on, what was available and what contacts were had early on. So we do want to change some of that. I think right now we're looking to expand the project, and that's kind of where the project's going. So we look for more.
And when you approach someone to do this, what's been the general response? Is it, oh my gosh, yes, I'd love to tell my story, or wait, what? And it takes some trust building to get them going?
Well, I think it's a combination. I think people are eager to tell their stories, and I think people who live in rural places in particular may feel a bit disenfranchised by not having their stories heard. So it really depends on the person. Some people are very eager to talk. They're great at telling stories. You know, they want to do this. Other people are a little reluctant. I know I have neighbors that I've been asking to participate in the project, and they're like, well, you know, I'm not really sure I want to talk about this, or I'm not really sure I have a sense of what that is. And I always ask them as a question to start that potential conversation is, what do you think rural is? How do you identify yourself as a rural person? And inevitably, there's a moment of hesitation there where they try to frame that in their mind or bring to mind what things they value in a rural place that help shape that identity.
Well, let's listen to some of these stories. You talked to one farmer named George who knew early on that he wanted to be a farmer. Let's take a listen.
When I got out of grade school, I just wanted to go into farming. I didn't want to go to school anymore. So in high school, I was old enough, and there wasn't a law then that you had to go to high school, so I stayed home. I wanted to take up some kind of forestry conservation. Then I had to make the decision. Dad would be alone on the farm. He couldn't do it anymore. He was getting old. So what do? Stay home and help Dad, or do I go off to college?
So you spent your life as a farmer happily?
I don't know where the happiness comes in it.
Huh. What do you make of that one? He wanted to be a farmer early on, but he's not sure about the happiness. It's interesting.
It is. I think that, again, that person's life is as complicated as anyone's. I mean, we all struggle with this. What do we do? How do we make choices? What sort of choices do we make that impact our family or ourselves? You know, what do we give up to have something else? What gives us joy or pleasure? What's hard? You know, what's a struggle? Those things are questions that everyone has. This idea of happiness, it's elusive. You ask anyone this question, no matter where they live, and they're going to have a response that may be similar. How do we define happiness? What makes us satisfied? You know, how do we live a full and rich life in place?
Happiness is also kind of a word that's more in vogue now, I think, when you're assessing life quality than it used to be. It used to be you lived a decent life, a moral life, a good life, but it wasn't always about happiness.
Right. I mean, I think that's true. And again, I think that's another reason to capture these stories. How has that changing sort of value landscape or moral landscape even, you know, what does that mean? How has that been shaped in a prior time? How is it being shaped now? I know that I'm working with young people all the time, every day. And when I talk to them about what matters to them or what has meaning to them, that's shifting all the time.
Well, staying with George's story, he, I guess, faced some difficulties in school. He came from a bohemian background. His teacher wanted to Americanize him more. Here's another excerpt from that interview.
She would come by my desk. Well, she'd walk around the room, you know, and when she'd come to my desk, she would pound on that desk. What's the matter, kid? Ain't you got no brung up? This is my English teacher. And I'd look, oh, my gosh, can I crawl under the desk? And the other kids in the room would be going,
Well, that's probably a common story for immigrants, urban and rural, over the years from a lot of ethnic backgrounds. Have you heard other stories like that in this project?
Yeah, I think there's always something, especially from the older rural residents, that is connected to a sort of transition into a different kind of place. You know, and often that transitions between rural and urban or a place that's not rural, often when they attended school or they were involved in some sort of labor that took them to a different place than maybe often the farm, sometimes just rural. So that shifting, that sort of story is often retold. I think the other thing is even in younger people, I know there is a sort of disenfranchisement of rural and a discounting. When I was working in Indiana and teaching there, I would ask students, you know, where are you from? What's your story? And often with some again, trepidation and shame even. They'd say, I'm from a rural place. You know, my family grows peanuts or soybeans or whatever. And so, again, I think often the attitude is by people that may be very proud to have grown up and lived in a rural place when they reach a point where they're encountering a different sort of population of people with a different background, they have to rethink how that's viewed.
And I want to hear a little more from this project. Now, one of the other people you talked to spoke of land conservation as not just a way of life, but something that should be revered, respected, and passed on. Here's a clip from that.
It was a given that you were, you know, God had provided you with this land, and it was your obligation to take care of it. You would learn it from the pulpit. You would learn it from your ancestors, so to speak. They would sort of pass it along, that this was a given, that this was something that you would continue.
And Matt, that idea of the land, how did that evolve as you talked to more people?
Well, I think that, again, there was a particular time in our more recent history where the idea of land use, and in particular in relation to agricultural use, was pretty well grounded as an identity in rural Wisconsin. And I think now, you know, and I think when I talk to people that are younger, they recognize the contested landscape of the rural landscape. And if you listen to the news or attend to politics at all, you see that those contested territories impact rural people probably most significantly. So there's a shift now where people are trying to understand, you know, what does it mean to have a job in a rural place? How is that tied into resources in a landscape that I live in? How do I preserve that landscape or not to maintain its rural character? Again, what do I value? How do I identify with this place? How do I identify as a rural person? So, again, that's changing all the time. And there's 68 interviews. I haven't listened to all of them. Mm. Certainly, there's a lot more in the archive that we've generated to date to certainly mine and look for some of those questions to be answered.
We're talking with Matt Groshek of the People of Rural Wisconsin Project, and we'd like to hear from you, too.
How do you think the place you live in shapes your identity? Did you grow up in a rural area or an urban area? And do you think rural and urban areas have more in common than we might think? Or maybe, as Matt was saying, this idea sometimes that the rural gets passed over, even in Wisconsin, where we have a lot of rural area in the state. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking about the People of Rural Wisconsin Project, which looks to capture the stories, the voices of the state's rural residents, and look at some pretty deep questions about place and who we are. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. If you live in rural Wisconsin, why do you live there? Is that where you grew up and you stayed, or did you have a vision of a place different than where you grew up? What is it about the rural landscape, living in a rural setting, that appeals to you? Is there a story you'd like to share, and how do you see the relationship between where we live and who we are as people? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Matt, we're talking here about rural Wisconsin. What is your connection with the rural in the state?
So I am a rural resident now. I grew up in central Wisconsin in a place called Rudolph, and I actually live there again. So I ended up leaving the area, lived in urban places, Milwaukee, Chicago, Indianapolis, and now I've actually come back to the same property that I grew up on. So I'm, again, a rural resident.
Oh, what is that like coming back again?
So it's funny because people ask this question often, and they ask me about being nostalgic and sort of embracing or engaging that nostalgia. And it's really about coming around again to something that's very different. I mean, I'm a very different person. My life is very different than when I left here. The place is very different. The world is a different place. So it's very exciting to have some connections that persist, especially in the landscape. And there's certain attributes of that landscape that I absolutely love. So it's, for me, it's been really terrific to come back and to have a life that's very different than an urban life and still have some things that are connected to an urban life. So it's been great for me.
Let's check out another one of the interviews that your project has collected for a woman named Margaret. Nature makes her feel like royalty. Here's a little of what she had to say.
We went out into nature, and that was always our delight. I remember Eddie asked me if I wanted to learn how to handle horses, and he let me cut a field of hay, not a whole field, but he but at least he set me on this thing. And I thought, this is absolutely divine, the fragrance of the hay and the blue sky with a few clouds up above, and here I am like a princess.
Wow, so just rapturous about having the opportunity to get up, lead the horses, and work a field, and make her feel like royalty, though this is something that royalty typically probably wouldn't do. Do you get that rapture from a lot of the people talking about the landscape?
Yeah, I think that people communicate that pretty well. Often it's a bit subtle, but you know, other times there's certainly an exuberance about that. And I think people describe a kind of rush in experiencing things that are larger than themselves. They're not human. It reminds them of maybe a context that they don't dominate, that something else dominates. And I think people have a rich appreciation for that live in rural places. Often that's a big part of the interview.
Do you think that is a surprise maybe for people who themselves don't live in rural areas, that there is such passion to the place where these people live? It's not an incidental choice. It's not a failure. It's not somewhere they just landed. It's intention, and it's also joy, like we heard.
Yeah, I think people in urban places, if they've never lived in a rural place, or if a rural place is only that space you drive through as fast as you can to get to an urban place, you know, they may struggle with understanding what that is. And the thing that also comes through the interviews, I think, is that's not always incredibly beautiful, pleasurable experience. That part of the experience of rural may be that it's dirty. You know, it may offer a struggle. It may challenge someone physically or mentally or emotionally in a way that, and I'm not saying urban places don't do this, but it's very different at times than what those challenges are in an urban place. And really this is about people who come from different tribes sort of trying to share stories. And again, it's the value of the project. We get to hear that voice, maybe understand it, find a resonance that is not us in those other things, and realize this person probably goes through similar things that I go through. Maybe the scale is different. Maybe the thing that drives that response is different, but it's existing in the same sort of manner. So
we'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We have Brian with us in Cumberland. Brian, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about, Brian?
I do agree, just like the gentleman was talking. I did grow up in a rural area and then never actually left and actually live on the farm that I grew up on. We feel, me and my wife feel, and our kids now are growing in their 22 and 24, that their lives have been very well grounded with the rural community and being on a farm, that when things come up in life and how things don't always go well, or, you know, but in, when you grow cattle and stuff, sometimes cattle do not make it. And the kids are very well grounded in life, I think,
Brian,
growing up in a rural area.
Brian, thank you so much for calling. So, Matt, this idea of this is a great place to raise kids, it really connects them with the planet in a way and with reality. Do you hear that a lot?
Yes. I think that comes through often. I think people, and again, this is sometimes about the hardships that you encounter if you live a rural life. And it may be that you're not a farmer, but you're going to see things die. You're going to see things suffer. You're going to see things fail that might be more immediate in their impact in relation to your life in particular. I think, again, urban places have some of the same conditions, but there's often a buffer there. So yes, I think one of the things we're hearing from people is that, you know, raising a family in those particular places has been important, especially. And again, I'm informally asking people some of these questions before I would do an interview with them, and it comes up often.
We're going to hear from another one of your voices now. This is Loretta, a 92-year-old Wisconsin woman who's known to her friends as Dimp.
I don't like the city at all. I always said that I don't want to live in the city at all. My sister, she's dead now, but she lived in Richland Center. And I said, I used to go down there and visit her, and I thought, how in the world can she stand living in town? One time my husband and I took a trip to Canada, and we got up there and everybody talked French. We decided to come back home.
That's awesome. She's got such such joie de vivre, and she expresses herself pretty well. What was she like?
And again, I did not meet Dimp. My experience of her is through that interview. So I can't, you know, I can't speak to that personally. But when I hear this, I hear, again, someone who in some ways I think has made up her mind about where she wants to be and the people she wants to be around. In some ways, it might suggest a kind of narrow viewpoint. But again, I think that's common to everyone. You decide, you know, what tribe you want to be around, and where that tribe lives might drive that very much so. So I think there's a delightfulness in how she puts that desire to live in a place. This other notion about I could never live in a city, you hear, again, it's one of the things we hear. I would never want to live there. I've never have decided to move to a city. And again, I think there's another place where do we really represent the urban very well to people that live in rural places, because there's a richness in that in rural places and urban places that, you know, can be found if you have to look for it or if you find yourself in those places. So,
you know, we hear in Wisconsin of a divide. Sometimes it's expressed as Madison and everything else, or Madison, Milwaukee, and Green Bay and the small towns and rural areas. Is part of this project, you know, trying to address that, to understand each other's viewpoints and cultures, and hey, maybe we got more in common than we might think?
Yeah, I think when I think of this project and I think of this idea of a polarity between urban and rural, I really think there's a continuum that ranges from, you know, a kind of sense of wildness to rural, semi-rural, suburban, urban, you know, post urban, if you will. There's really a range of experiences that people have. They're connected to place very often and identities. But really, across that continuum, you have relationships that go back and forth all the time. In fact, some of the research recently by some groups investigating rural conditions have found that a lot of people, you know, 100 days out of their year, they're working in an urban place and they live in a rural, you know, site. Or what they're doing is they're living in a rural place and they're commuting to an urban space. And so, and the other thing is we can't exist in isolation from any of those things. There's a mosaic of place and life opportunities across the state. Those things are all connected. In a way that's amazing. And I think we forget those connections, again, because we want to preserve some identity. So I think the project offers, again, a sort of maybe a fuzziness about, you know, what do these things mean and where are they similar? And also, how do we depend on each other? This is about interdependence, and we have it all the time. We can't exist in isolation. I think especially now we have connections to the whole world. How do you frame your personal identity, your sense of place with something that might also include an identity that's a world identity? I mean, this is the question. These are the questions. They're interesting and exciting, especially in the 21st century.
Matt, thanks so much for sharing these stories with us. And we'll probably check in with you as you take it forward.
Okay. Thank you very much, Veronica and Rob. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about the project.
That's Matt Groshek. He's the project director for People of Rural Wisconsin. Well, I, you know, grew up dirt road. We occasionally got mudded out, cows across the street, cornfield behind us. Now I'm in a mid-sized city. And I don't know, I'm kind of split sometimes. Like, I see real advantages to the way I grew up. Do you ever think, Veronica, of that would be better to raise kids where they can run wild and free?
I miss some of my times in Campbellsport, Wisconsin,
yeah,
actually,
right.
Which one year was left off the map. I guess
right,
that's how insignificant cartographers thought it was. I'm sure it was an oversight. But it was a beautiful place, and I do miss that and the quiet and the peace of it sometimes.
All right. Well, great conversation. Hey, keep sharing your thoughts and stories over at the Central Time Facebook page.